Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor, writer, director, producer, and the voice of the world's dumbest chicken, Alan Tudyk. When I learned that Alan Tudyk spent a good part of his youth skateboarding and making prank calls, I knew I'd like him. My daughters already loved him. After all, he's voiced characters in nearly every Disney film in the last decade. What this guy can do with one picture and his imagination is, well, beyond imagination. You've seen lots of him on screen as well, in films like Dodgeball, 28 Days, Death at a Funeral, and the cult favorite sci-fi series Firefly. He brought rare comedic skill and timing to all those roles, but mostly from the sidelines. Where he wanted to be was in the middle of the story. So after almost 20 years in the business, Alan decided to write that story himself, against the advice of his agents and some very tall odds. That story was Con Man, and when studios didn't bite, he went to the very fans his Con Man character insults to raise money for the series. What happened next changed not only how he saw his career, but how he saw himself. Join me for an hour of bloody knees, nutty voices, observant teachers, Broadway dreams, and artistic risk. You'll also hear how well improv goes over on the set of Star Wars. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Hi, Alan.
Hey, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. My absolute pleasure.
You know, I have become enthralled with your work lately. I saw Con Man a few months ago, and I just got hooked on it. And I'm not a big sci-fi guy or anything, but it's really good. And after sort of getting into that, I realized that you've done every voice that my kids have ever seen in every movie, because they're the perfect age for the Alan Tudyk era of Disney. You know what I mean? Like,
the Alan Tudyk era.
Frozen was their first big one that they watched for, you know, they watched 20 times over.
And
learned every song, and obviously Zootopia and Moana. And my older daughter just watched Rogue One a couple weeks ago for the first time. And so you just have this really interesting career, and I want to talk to you all about that. But in doing my research, I found that you and I have something in common.
What?
We both put off homework and other things we were supposed to do in high school to go skateboarding.
Oh, yeah, man.
I've been a skater my whole life.
Did you do big ramps or street skating?
I did ramps. I did pools. I grew up out here, so.
Wow. You're better than me.
No, probably. Like
you're better than me. I was into street. I was a lot of street, a lot of ditches, launch ramps.
Oh, yeah. I did the launch ramp thing.
Those were really fun.
Learning the judo air off the launch ramp.
Judo air, man. I had an okay method air.
Although, did you really?
Yeah, it turned into a mosquito a lot where it, like, you know, it turned out I met Tony Hawk. I was on a show and he was another guest. And somebody said, Tony Hawk's in the other dressing room. And I became suddenly I was 14, 15 again, 16. 17, 18. I stammered. I saw you in Houston. I saw you in Houston. My friends and I. He's like, get this kid out of here. But he was nice. But I hadn't experienced that before, where suddenly I just became a stammering. Wow, I didn't expect it.
It's a funny
thing.
Yeah, it's a funny thing when you have, at a certain age, when you have these heroes that did stuff that you wanted to do so badly.
Yeah.
You clearly, from my research, had acting in your, sort of, like, you were sort of a natural at it, even in high school, and yet it seemed to me from reading about you that you sort of denied it or didn't want to do it or didn't believe in it, or if it was your calling, you weren't answering right away. Is that sort of true?
It is. I did a lot of competition acting, which I do in Texas. We would go to schools, sometimes out of town, and I would do humorous interpretation was my big thing, and you would do although back in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, I think this was training, you would do impromptu, would you compete with other people, you'd pull three little pieces of paper out of a hat, and it would be like, my microwave blew up. Eggs and bacon. Just like, you'd pick one, you'd have 60 seconds to come up with a four-minute speech, and then you'd give a speech. And what I did well at it because I'd choose a character. So my microwave blew up. I was a French chef who talks about the worst. There was time. This is a terrible accent. I think I'm going German. But his microwave blew up, and the little chicken legs and the wings on the ceiling, and just going off as a character in an improvisation. And that you could win trophies, which I really thought was fun, because I didn't do sports, and my brother had trophies.
That's such a strange entree into acting. I mean, even if other people did enter competitions, it's not really the story you hear a lot. You usually hear the high school play story.
Right. The high school teacher that we had who did the plays, I had had this odd opportunity when I was in middle school. So when I was like 12, I did a summer play that he directed, and he was mean. He was really mean, really strict. And so when I went into high school, this really big two-year high school, I was like, I don't want to do anything to do with that guy.
Oh, he was still the guy.
He was still the guy. And so I just did the competition. If I didn't pass, I couldn't compete. So I didn't pass a lot of classes a lot of the times because I was off skateboarding. So I didn't compete a lot. I decided early on I wanted to get married. I really wanted to get married for some reason. I don't know.
When you were in high school?
Just in life. I knew I wanted to be married. It was something I wanted to do. My parents, I don't know, I guess they're still married. I just thought that was something I wanted to do. Very romantic guy. And whenever I was in school and my teachers, whenever I had a teacher, drama teacher, speech teacher, I'd say, hey, so were you ever an actor? Yes, I was. What happened? What are you doing here? Well, I did a few plays, I did this, I did that, and then I got married. And it would always end there.
And you put this together.
I'm like, can't get married. A, you can't get married, and B, you're poor. They would always say, if you just work in this business, without ever becoming famous, you think about becoming an actor, you're going to be famous. No. If you just work and you make a living your whole life, you're a huge success. And as a kid, you're like, I hate you. How dare you? No, you have to achieve. You have to win. So I don't know. I knew that I would have to do something else, something that involved poverty without a spouse. And
what did your dad do?
He owned his own business called Industrial Seal Supply. You know, like seals that in fountains or things, you know, anything with pressure, hydraulics.
So was the message ever from your parents like, you've got to have security?
My dad wanted me to take over his business. He wanted one of us to. One of my brother, myself, and then ultimately my sister. But it just wasn't our thing. So I think he ultimately came to the conclusion that, you know, this was his dream, and we have our dreams as well that aren't going to necessarily match up with his.
Yeah.
But he wasn't as on board with me being an actor as much as my mom.
Oh, really?
You know, like, when you're... I grew up in Texas. I remember one time my cousin, I was down... San Antonio. He's like, man, you're going to be an actor. That's crazy. I mean, is it hard? I said, here's something that's hard about it. I got a watch for Christmas. I took it back and took the money and bought makeup. What? Well, hell, that's screwed up. That's part of it. Like, you got to, it's hard for my dad to get maybe. That definitely wasn't his experience in life.
Yeah.
I got to get some makeup and that stuff's expensive. You know, he doesn't.
So at a certain point, this culminated in you thinking, like, I'm not going to act because...
Well, I was good at... I was working at this place called Taco Bueno.
Yeah?
Like, it was like Taco Bell. It was better than Taco Bell. And I was great at it. From 16 on, I was just like, man, I can be the manager here. I'm just good worker guy. And so I thought, hotel restaurant management, I got this. And I started going to this after-school thing. I was going to a hotel, and you followed him around, and I was really into it.
Oh, you were serious?
Yeah. So I was gonna do that. And then my speech teacher, which was where you did the competition, Charlotte English, she said, I hear that that's what you're going to do. I said, yeah. And she goes, we got time. Let's take a walk. And we took a walk around the school, and when I was done, I was like, okay, I'll be an actor. Because she full on just said, you can make it.
Like, really?
Like, how do you know that? She just was bold for a teacher to say, now that I think about it.
Yeah, but I mean, I would think that something was there even then.
Yeah.
Right?
You know what she cited? One of the things she cited was, I came to class, I had ripped my knee up skateboarding.
Yeah.
At lunch, it was just, you know, lunch. Anyway, ripped it up and it was bleeding down into my sock. And people were like, your knee's bleeding. Yeah, so what, man? I think it looks good. It matches my shirt. I think it's great. That she took that as an attitude or I don't know, I was different enough or
he's an
something.
Artist.
Yeah, he's got his own thing.
Yeah.
And I wore crazy clothes to school.
But did you sort of have enough self-awareness to know that you were a bit different?
I always thought my fellow students were better than me.
Really?
Yeah, and a couple of them are still in it. Jeremy Schwartz, a buddy of mine, won more trophies than me. So did Greg Wilson. He won more trophies than me. And I always cited that as they're better than me. And no offense to those guys, but on my walk, Charlotte Inger said, no, you're better than they are.
Like, really?
We broached the subject. I'm like, I'm not good enough. I'm not as good as him. I'm not as good as her. And she's like, nope, you're better than them all. I don't know what, you know, I guess she saw some. Things have worked out.
When did you recognize that in yourself? Like, when did you sort of discover that you were funny or that you were quick?
When I was little, I could get out of trouble. I got out of trouble a lot. I was great at getting into trouble and then getting out of trouble with my mouth. I could make people laugh. My mother always said that I would just push it until the moment where I pushed it one step further and found a way to flip it, and she'd laugh and I would get off without getting in trouble, grounded.
Really?
Or whatever. Yeah. And I remember when I was little, there was a thing, I don't know, I was just always in character. I loved cartoons. I remember going by the feed bag burger place. They had these Western doors, which I loved, and I kicked them open at like age 7 and was like, I'm Black Bart and I'm here to, I don't know, rob the place or something. The whole restaurant was freaked out and laughing, and my mom, it was like one of those, you know, family stories that always.
And were you a prank caller as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, I had a good one. Oh, I had some stupid ones. Okay, so the best one that I did a lot. And I would pick one guy, and I'm sorry, Tony, I did this to you. I'd call, we'd call, and I'd pick out of the phone book. I'd be like, yes, hello, is this Tina Marks? Yes. Well, we have your order of 50 feet of Mighty Rope, and we haven't received your pay, and we're here to collect. It's $125. Wait, what is this? What are you talking about? Mighty Rope. Is this Tina? Give the address. Yes? Well, you ordered Mighty Rope. It's a chemically treated rope that was only formerly sold to construction, and now it's been made available to the public, and you ordered it. The husband would get on. We'd say, look, you know what? This is just my job to call in and find out where the money is. You have to call Tony at this number and just send all these irate people to this one number. And the other one I just remember the other day was calling barbershops. This is so awful. Call barbershops and say, I need to bring my son in there for a burr. Y'all do burrs? Like a burr, which is it's just a southern name where you completely like clipper the hair down short. A burr. Yes, sir, we can do a burr. All right, well, you just need a heads up on this. His scalp bleeds a lot. Yeah, he's got a bleeding scalp. He's got it. And then if they were like, this is a prank call. Get mad about it. My son has this problem, and you're laughing about it. Obviously, you're...
So you would take it further, where I'd be like, oh, they're onto us. I'd hang up. You would just keep going.
Yes. Me and Greg B. would do that. Ah, it was fun.
So even at that age, you committed to a role. You stuck to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
God, I loved prank calls. You know, we used to put ads in the recycler when it was free saying that there's a garage sale. We'd put all these great items and then our friend's house, you know, and then that morning.
That's great. That is a step.
Everyone would be
man.
Showing up. Or we put in, you know, free puppies, golden retrievers. We have 8. Give us a call. And they would just be.
Wow.
But the voice thing,
glad we didn't live near one another.
We'd have just blown up the town.
Yeah, it would not have been good.
We'd be bleeding profusely. Just
Miss English would have said, you should be an actor. You should get, we could have.
I know. We would have had phone books dangling from our hips. You know, so we could just prank call.
One leg stronger than the other because of just carrying that phone book.
Yeah.
Limping. Maybe it's best we didn't live.
Yeah.
One another.
Well, okay, so this I also find fascinating, Juilliard.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've talked to a fair number of people who have gone to Juilliard and other acting schools. And, you know, there seems to be an era, especially at Juilliard, where people did not have a good time. And this was your experience to some extent, right?
Yes. I left my third year because I didn't like it. That's not to say I didn't learn a lot and have benefited from what I learned, but it's different now. It's a really great school now. My class was mental, and for a long time we were known by other classes as that, oh, you were in group 26, whoa. Individually, we were. There's some great people. Some had real problems. But together, we were just awful. I mean, the school was a little bit like, what's going on with this class? This class is the worst. But also, there was huge pressure in the school where they strip you down, you know, and then they build you back up. So that gives them a lot of power in your life, because that you get there, like, you're not sitting right, you're not speaking right, you're not doing any, what you think is good acting is not good acting, we're going to reteach you everything. And it screws with your head, and you end up having to trust them incredibly. And there were some teachers there who didn't deserve it. They were cruel. There was one woman, one voice teacher, that anybody who worked with her, L.S., she doesn't teach anymore, but there's a famous story where a kid missed class for a while because his father had passed away, and he went away to the funeral, came back, and she said, you have missed class. Where have you been? And he said, my father died. She said, you mean to say your father died? Like, they were, when I said door, and I was told, no, it's not door, it's door.
You're kidding me.
Sorry, it's what? Door. It's an aw sound. It's like, and I'm out. There was a lot more to it, but that was
this
the last.
This was only 17 years ago, and they wanted you to all talk like you were in a Preston Sturges movie.
Yes. There was a way to say your S's had to sound like a little bit of water being thrown onto a skillet.
Would they say that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, and it helped me immensely, that part of it, because voice, you know, doing accents, I can now hear sounds that I wouldn't have had my ear as fine-tuned as it is now.
Right.
That putting together accents and things like that just became more specific.
But at the time, coming from clearly, like, the comedy bent that you had, how did that work there?
Not well. Not well, man. That's what drove me crazy and helped make, you know, push me out the door was, we just didn't do comedies, and most of my class had no interest in comedy. I mean, like 90% of my class didn't have interest in comedy.
And did you have someone in mind, like someone whose career you looked at, like, how do I get there? I mean, what was your plan in Juilliard in terms of what's my next step?
There were two students who left Juilliard in their third year, and they started working immediately. They weren't doing the kind of work I wanted to do. They're both really good-looking guys, and they were doing sort of leading man stuff.
Right.
But I saw that as that's what I want to do. I want to be the third year guy who leaves, because a lot of the fourth year people couldn't get work. I'm like, there's a thing about leaving in your third year. I want to do that. I would do readings, anything I could find, anything on the weekends. There was a playwright. They brought in all these playwrights to teach at Juilliard for the first time. Christopher Durang and Marsha Norman were the teachers. It was really great. David Auburn was in there, who's now won a Pulitzer for Proof. So he was like, Alan, you want to do this on the weekend? Come in and read this. Yep, I'm coming in. Whatever I can do. And doing those, I got seen by a producer who at New York Stage and Film, upstate New York, went there my summer between second and third year, and everything started there for me. I met, there were like all these new directors, and especially there was a play called Bunny Bunny, which I did the workshop for. And when I got back to school, I knew enough people, mover shakery people within the business that I got a toehold. Nikki Silver, playwright, he heard about me through a director, called me into audition, didn't give me the role, but he said, he called me, he's like, you don't have an agent, I don't get it. So I've called two agencies on your behalf, is that okay? So then I had an agent, and then I was like, I could get out of Juilliard.
So you just needed to get out in the real world and...
Yes, because that Bunny Bunny was characters. It was a three-person play about Alan Zweibel and Gilda Radner, their life together. Alan Zweibel was one of the first writers on SNL, and Gilda Radner, of course.
Right.
And it was there. It's called An Almost Love Story, and they were friends, very close friends. And it's like, were they going to get together? Were they not? And they just had this life together as friends. and I was 20-something characters around them. I came in as a French waiter to start off to say, if I could offer you one of the hot, sorry, it's in the, and just do a bit, then walk off, and then come back on. Is this different character who's going to be upset? Big Bone Judy.
Oh, so you were the world around these two people.
Yeah.
And every character they ran into was you.
Yeah. So it was wigs and...
That's like a microcosm of your entire career.
And it was the thing that kicked off, like in New York. It ended up being going off Broadway. And I was broke, man. I was so broke. And we're waiting for a theater. I get a call from the producer. There's no theater. It's not going to happen. Hopefully next year. Sorry, you're going to have to wait. Ugh. I'm going to have to get a real job again. I went to the bar closest to me, which was in at the bottom of my building on 10th Avenue. It was a transvestite bar called Carla's 2, T-O-O. And sat down and had a scotch with a friend, and the bartender was bitching about how he needed somebody to work. And I said, well, I'm a bartender. I can bartend for you. So I went to work there. My girlfriend was on Broadway in Present Laughter, and she brought the cast around for my first night and only night working there. It was such a crazy evening. If I wanted to write a book, I knew it. I'm like, if I want to write a novel, stay in this job. I didn't. I've never written a novel, so I left. She brought her cast by to go to a dive bar, and I'm like, babe, this is not the kind of dive bar. This is sad. It's a sad place with Chi-Chi the bitch, who was very nice, who wanted me to take her duck hunting. And there was this guy going, hey, I work here. You know, you can give me my drinks free. And meanwhile, the other guy's like, do not give him his drinks free. And I'm getting stuck between and the guy going, you're cute. I heard you, you're cute. Did you want a beer? You're cute. Okay, nice leather cap. So Chi-Chi the bitch is wanting to go duck hunting. The guy's like, I'm not gay. Hey, I'm not gay. I work around. You give me my drinks for free. And then as he got drunker in the evening, Chi-Chi the bitch ended up on his lap and his hands going up her skirt. I'm like, this is hell. But my girlfriend brought into this establishment Allison Janney and some of the cast of Present Laughter. It was, you're like taking worse vodka than Absolut and pouring it into the Absolut. Like, it was terrible. Yeah. The olives were, anyway. That year. So then Bunny gets a theater out of the blue. I quit. That year, they gave an award, the Clarence Derwin Award, to the best New York City debut. They gave it to one woman and one man. They gave it to me and Allison Janney. Isn't that crazy?
You're kidding me.
Yeah, so I had, like, been serving her martinis at the worst bar in the world, and then a few months later was receiving this award that had cash with it, which was great back then.
Well, but that's amazing to me that not only were you voted that honor basically in your first ever job, right? Like,
right,
first real theater job.
In New York, yeah, definitely.
And, I mean, how many characters did you play in that?
I think it was like 20-something. It was great. It was in the director, Chris Ashley, who just won a Tony this year, in the playbill, he wrote Alan Zweibel, or had them write, Alan Zweibel, Bruno Kirby, Paula Kael as Gilda Radner, Alan Tudyk, French waiter, Alan Tudyk, camera operator, Alan Tudyk, bouncer, Alan Tudyk, Big Bone Judy. So when you first sat down, there's this guy,
this is a
Alan
big cast.
Tudyk. Yeah.
And then you
see Alan Tudyk, you're like, well, how is this guy going to pull this off? What's the trick? So it set up people to, you ended up watching, like, what's going to be next? You know, it was a great roles to have.
That's amazing. You know, I was thinking about Steve the Pirate.
Yar.
Uh-huh. Yar. Because I think Steve the Pirate is a great metaphor for what acting is, really, which is Steve the Pirate just believed he was a pirate, right?
Yeah.
Like, I guess thinking about Steve the Pirate is a good way to think about the common work that you have to do for every character, right? And I just wondered if there was a point in your life when you figured out how to make those people real, or if you are just somebody who, through your imagination, can create a real character fully formed in your head and see them that way.
Some are easier than others. You know, characters just... I did, there was a character in 28 Days with Sandra Bullock, was one of the first
roles. Right, the German...
Yes, German. His name is Gerhard Weinacht. And immediately I knew this person. And he didn't talk fast, so I could think, I don't know, he was just an easy character to do and to come up with many things to say. And that one was easier. Pirate Steve was, the challenge was different because, like you said, you need to make it believable. But also mainly he said Gar and Yar. And so, you know, it'd be like Gar or yeah, you know, just reacting in with what was happening, but just using those sounds and finding the places to put them that are funny and not just not enough already. We right. get it. And it's funny. You can tell yourself, you know the process. The main thing that acting, if you had to boil it down to one thing, is what do you want? What does the character want? And I find it's the first thing to go out the window. I'm acting still to this day. Oh, he's this, he's that, he's got a thing. This is his background. This is, oh, wait, what do I want? What does my character want? I feel like I'm just now starting to get acting. Like, I really feel like I'm starting to piece some things together.
When you say that, what comes to mind? Like, what lesson comes to mind?
I'm about to do a play, a Steve Martin play.
Right, with Amy Schumer.
With
right?
Amy, yeah. And going over the play, it's a very funny play, as you would imagine, that I will see the written joke and start playing the joke, that the joke will work with sadness here, and then immediately, oh, that's happy. That it's that opposite, that it occurs to you as you read it. Ah, that's what makes it funny. And like, you've got to throw all that away and just sit in what the character wants and what he's feeling in that moment. And then those things will come naturally. But my brain that's trained as a comedic actor or a writer now knows what's being required to make it funny, but you have to let it all go and trust. If you follow the way through, you're going to get there, and it will be much more interesting and original. It won't just be an idea of an emotion, an idea of what you feel, an idea of what you want in that moment. It won't be anything about what you want. You know, action. That's what's called acting. What do you want? What is your action?
And how do you do that work?
Going through and reading the thing. You can read a thing. You'll do a play. I did a play, Prelude to a Kiss. It was a great role. It had he never left stage. There's a great arc within it. And there were still days where you'd be doing the 50th performance and you go, oh, wait a second. Your character's never been to my house. So now you're in here and I'm treating you as if somebody who's always been here. That's a realization. You realize things within the script as you read it again, read it again, read it again. Those are the types of things you think of. Like, oh, I put on the tea earlier and it's in the script that I never pour tea. Maybe that's a clue to what's going on in the scene. If I never make the tea, why? And then you come up with a reason why your character might not make tea, and it becomes something interesting
right.
in the thing.
You have to build everything around that's not written. You still have to know it.
Yeah.
You know, it makes me think, and maybe this is a good time to talk about Con Man, because it makes me think of having to do that work as long as you've done it, as many roles you've done that, where you've had to sit down with a script and figure out a character. And then you write your own series.
Right.
You're creating a script for other people to do that work. I wonder how that process was for you, knowing how many times you've done prep on characters and creating characters, right. and how that translated to trying to create characters from scratch when right. you didn't have any clues.
It's amazing. It's incredibly helpful, because you can get into the head of a character. You know, when you're acting, you're worried about one character. You're focused on that character. And primarily. And then when you're writing, it's everybody. And you kind of have to get in their head. And I found it exciting, especially since a lot of the characters I was writing, for all the characters around me, I played the guy in the middle who was reacting to everything.
Yeah, we should say that Con Man is, you created it. It was financed through Indiegogo originally. Mm-hmm. And it's based on a character that's very similar to your experience on Firefly, which you did with Nathan Fillion.
Yeah.
And now you play with Nathan Fillion in Con Man. You both play actors who were on this sci-fi show years ago. He's gone on to be a big, giant movie star success, and you have the fear that maybe you're on the downside of your career and your life is spent going to comic conventions, signing posters.
Yeah.
It's more about the journey that this actor is going through with having to look in the mirror and face who he is, and the insanity that's going on all around him is just reflects how strange his life has become. And it's a fascinating series. But maybe we should start at the beginning and just tell me the impetus or the original idea and how it came to you. And
one of the reasons that I wrote it, it's not unlike a lot of people, why a lot of people write and make their own things, is because I wasn't getting a role, the kinds of roles. I wanted that guy in the middle role. And I always play the guys on the outside. You know, I played the Steve the Pirate, the guy who's affecting the story through my, you know, just from a side character. That was one small thing. Also, I was going to conventions after Firefly, and I was seeing this world that was being, you know, revealed to me, like, wow. And since I was from the outside looking in, none of it was normal.
Right.
I noticed everything about it. The crappy hotels. The fact that you didn't go into your... It's in London. And then, no, you don't go to London. You stay right by the airport. And that's not London. You're in the... And that's always...
You're in Gatwick.
You're in Gatwick. And you're trying to get the thing in town that you're supposed to buy for somebody, but you can't get to town. So that becomes, you know, for a story, that could be a great story for the character, like you said, the guy in the middle. So I wanted to tell the story of an actor in this world and to shine a light on those characters within the world who are so mental. It wasn't so much the fans, like a lot of people would think. And when you think of cons, you're like, those fans are crazy. They dress up and
right.
they're so... It wasn't them. It was the people, the photographer who would put his hand on ice, stop all photography, you know, their portrait photography they do there, because his finger, no, I need some Prosecco. And he'd, like, ice his hand. There's just some bizarre people. The managers, my manager in this, Mindy Sterling, is also for an Emmy.
Yeah.
So cool. There's the episode with Leslie Jordan, who is this hysterical man. You can just point a camera at that guy and just watch him go. But he comes in and he says he's attracted to women. He's like, I am a straight. That he goes after conservative cougars. So he just pretends to be a gay. He goes after conservative cougars because they've spent their lives telling themselves that homosexuality is a choice. And they know it's a lie, and it's eaten away at their heart. There's a hole inside of them. You know what I fill that hole with? My big old dick. I tell them, yes, homosexuality is a choice. You're right, and you have changed me. You have made me choose you. They let me do butt stuff, whatever I want. So I got to say that.
So basically you're saying you created Con Man so you could just say whatever you wanted.
Yes.
And you've never been able to do that before.
No. I can make everybody say whatever I want. That's the other thing. Like, if I want to say something as the author, I just have him say it or her say it. And it's not me, you know.
Well, what I'm wondering about that time in the life of the project where it went from an idea that you're messing around with to we're doing this.
I started writing it.
Had you written much before?
No.
It's amazing that you did that as your first project.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
No, and I would think that a lot of people have ideas of I will write myself a vehicle, but it doesn't happen that often that it makes it through to fruition.
I know. A lot of people want to make things and don't. A lot of people crowdfund things and make money, and then you're like, whatever happened to that? Just somewhere along the production, they just can't deliver it.
They took the money. They just didn't use the money and they to might make have, the thing.
Yeah, they might have spent it trying to make it, but they just never finished it. It takes so much to make a thing. I learned a lot doing plays. I learned a lot working with Alan Zweibel and Bunny Bunny because he's writing the whole time. And this joke isn't working. I play this guy who's a bouncer, who's only got one eye. And Bruno Kirby comes up and he starts out angry at me, and I'm real passive, but then I finally let him in. It's not working. The audience isn't laughing. Try it again. Nope, the audience still isn't laughing. All right, now your character's angry. Now he's passive. Now he's not on the list. Now the next time, the next rewrite, he is on the list. And so I got to watch the same joke being flipped and turned and until it worked.
So you saw the process that you ultimately adopted to write Con Man.
Yeah, by great people. Paul Rudnick, I did a play called Most Fabulous Story Ever Told, which was the story of Adam and Steve. And I was Adam. And you do these things so many times in a row. We worked on that play for almost a year before we went on stage, I feel like. And you learn it. I can't wait to do the Steve Martin play because I'm going to learn his comedy. You do 100 performances of a thing and you learn that, what the way their jokes work. But, you know, working with Paul Rudnick, I was, it was so funny. Like, he creates the world. Oh, my God, Adam's, oh, my God, this is amazing. Oh, it's so beautiful, so wonderful. I mean, I'd put the lake over there, but other than that, I love it. It was, God, it was funny. Really jokey writer, so I learned a lot of jokes there, just how to tell a joke and write a joke.
Right. So when you sat down to start doing it, how did it feel to sort of find out that you could write?
I took a class.
You did?
There was an actress, Jillian Vigman, who was on Suburgatory that I did, a TV show. She played my wife. Funny lady. She comes from Groundlings. And she was saying that she was writing a script, and I was like, I really want to do that. She said, come to this class. And I went, and the teacher was like, you can do this. This should be made. This absolutely should be made. Just keep writing, keep writing.
Did you have a bloody knee running down to your sock at that point?
Right. I was good with these teachers, with the creative teachers, the history teachers and the chemistry teachers. They didn't like me.
How did it work out that you ended up publicly financing it on Indiegogo? Because I guess my question is this. At a certain point of trying to get financing and not getting financing, a lot of people would say, all right, maybe this isn't the right time for the idea. Maybe I need to come up with another premise. I'll put this on the shelf. Like, what kept you going at it when traditional financing fell apart?
I guess it's that Pirate Steve thing where you're like, believe in it, you know. I believed it. I did. And my producing partner, P.J. Harzma, Nathan's also producer, Fillion, but P.J. was like, this is great. We need to make this. And we went around to Legendary. We went around to a few different established places. And they were always liked it, but things would fall through. And so there was almost so many times, there's a few almosts that keep you, you know, feeling like you've got it. It just didn't work out for the money or the way that they're still restructuring their whatever. And PJ was always, go to the fans. You've got fans for days. You've been nurturing these fans. You know, I go out all over the world to meet people. And you're like, this is truly, you know, legitimate. There's fans all over. If you and Nathan ask them for some money, I bet they'll give it to you.
What was your biggest concern about that? Because I'll tell you what I would be afraid of.
Okay.
I'd be afraid that you'd put it up there and set your goal at whatever number, and you wouldn't hit it, and it would be a public shaming.
Yes. I'm not great at asking for help anyway, but publicly asking for money?
Yeah.
For an idea?
That must have been hard.
It helped that a couple of people that we went to didn't get it, Con Man, because they thought it was making fun of the fans. And so we were sticking up for the fans, and those ones were like, no, it's not. You're not making fun of the fans. You got to make fun of they're the heroes. Although my biggest fear was, at the center of Con Man is my character who doesn't appreciate the fans.
Right.
So I was going to fans to write a show where I'm the star and I don't appreciate those same people who I'm asking money for. And I went to Tim Minear beforehand, who was one of the producers on Firefly and how he does American Horror Story. Brilliant guy. And he was nice enough to read all of my scripts. At least he said he did. But he read them and I said, you know what, I'm worried. My character says, I hate sci-fi in season one. When he's drunk, tells all these fans I hate it. That just even saying it was really hard. He said, if you don't have this guy at the center of your show, you don't have a show. So get over yourself. Do it. You have to do it. And we put it out there. We shot a scene, the bathroom scene where I'm in a stall and the guy next
hilarious.
To me.
Hilarious. Yeah.
Which was based on reality. I was at a stall in a bathroom, at a urinal. And the guy next to me, he turns and looks at me. He goes, oh, my God, you're Wash from Firefly. And then the guy over here goes, who are you? What is Wash? God, all right, both of you, stop it. Like, look what's in your hand. Let's not, we don't talk here. I'll meet you at the sinks if you need to discuss this further. And so it became a scene where.
Right.
And we shot that, put it out. We got to $1 million faster in 24 hours than anybody else. We hit all kinds of records.
How did that feel when the money started coming in?
For PJ, my producing, one of my producing partners, he was thrilled. He was thrilled. I was immediately nervous. That's me.
Like, now we have to make it.
We have to make this the greatest show ever. These people have entrusted us with their money. We have to not screw this up. And yeah, I was a little nervous. And then we kept, the comic books. Like, okay, so we've funded the entire series that I've written now. Let's go. Do you want to fund a comic book? We'll write some comic books. Okay, great. We funded a comic book. Let's fund a novel. Let's fund a video game that we would, or it's an app. It's Con Man the Game that you can get on your phones. So they outdid themselves. After we made the money for the episodes, I was like, cut it off. We're done. We did it. We don't need any more money. Indiegogo's like, I'm sorry, what? No, it doesn't work like
that. You've
tapped
into a pipeline of free cash, and now you want to turn the spigot off? No.
Of which we get a percentage. So,
right.
You will be doing the entire month. And so I'm glad they did, because we were able to finance all these other things.
But it's so fascinating. I mean, the thing that gets me about the show is that it really is, at its heart, super relatable and sympathetic towards anyone who has this fear that they're on the downside of their career, or that they're not going to get hired again, or they're not good enough, or they see other people around them doing better. But it's also the reality in the arc of an artist, which is you have no control over your career, because it's the business. And I wonder how much you tapped into your own experiences or fears of being an actor, because I feel like, as humorous as the show is and farcical or whatever, at its core, there's something very relatable about that fear and self-esteem that comes with being an actor.
Yeah, as far as being the guy, you can't be the guy you want to be, because that guy's going to go to somebody more famous, because they got to, definitely that you get financed. The financing decides, marketing decides who is cast. That happens all the time, again and again and again. You get used to it. That's definitely the story. I mean, things have gotten better for me than for Ray, but those things have happened. Those, being miscast and, I was miscast right in the beginning. I had a role taken away from me and given a lesser role right in the beginning of my career.
What was that?
It was Miss Alliance at the Roundabout. And I auditioned. There were three roles. They're like, this is right after Bunny Bunny. Like, there's three roles you could play, any one of these. One is sort of the guy who's Johnny, or no, I don't know, some guy who's like a hero. One guy who shows up in the third act, steals the show. And then one is Bentley Summerhays, who's like this ineffectual. When he gets threatened, he just throws himself on the ground and says, oh, he's beating me. And I was like, all right, I'll audition for the two, not Bentley Summerhays, because I have no interest in doing that. I really wanted the guy who comes in, his name's Gunner, that he comes in the third act. So I auditioned, didn't hear back, and then I'm talking to my agent, and he says, oh, you need to make your mind up about that Miss Alliance thing. What Miss Alliance thing? I'm like, well, they want you to do it. It's like, well, yes, which role? He said, I don't know, which role did you want? I said, well, I told him in the room, I want Gunner, but I'll do the other. He's like, that's the one you got. And I go back to Bunny Bunny. We're still doing Bunny Bunny. I remember backstage talking to Paula Kale, going, I'm going to do this thing. Miss Alliance, I got my next job. I played the role of Gunner. And she's like, I really feel like I just had a conversation with Zach Orth, the actor, that he's playing Gunner. And I called the director, because I had his phone number from the New York Stage and Film thing I did that got me out of Juilliard, and said, what role do I have? Do I have Gunner? He said, Alan, you snooze, you lose. I was like, I snoozed? When did I snooze? I didn't know I was, even though I had the option. He's like, the role that's open now is Bentley Summerhays. I was like, no. So I did it, and I was miserable. And Gunner stole the role, just stole the whole show. Zach Orth did a wonderful job, but it was hard. It was hard for me, and I fired that agent, my God.
But that is a microcosm of an actor's life, right?
Yeah.
And the agent may have screwed up, and
he did.
Yeah.
And you can see that all my agents and managers, I'm always, if Ray Nearly and Com is always bitching about his agents. He's always, my agents left me in the process of going after Con Man. I mean, it was mutual. That's how agents leave you. They're like, I think we should all agree now to part ways. All right.
Yeah, I'm not agreeing to that.
Yeah, but I was passing up another pilot season because I was always just about to get financing, just about to make it. I'm like, if I do a pilot with a network, they won't let me do Con Man because they will consider that competition, and you have to have it in your contract for 7 years. And I passed up a job, basically.
A good one.
A good one that was being offered to me. I was like, nah. If you let me do Con Man, fine. They said, no. So I said, all right, give it up. And they just watched dollars go away. And so after I turned it down again, turned down something and wasn't going to do a whole pilot season, I said, we're done.
God, that strikes me, to have the conviction to take a self-finance thing and to stick with it, to turn down real work. Yeah. Did it give you a different perspective on how to go about your career from here on out?
The way I approach things now is completely different since Con Man, for sure. I mean, I was rolling the dice on Con Man at that point when my agents walked away. I mean, we weren't happy. I mean, they were right. They were so fed up with me. I was turning down roles that they'd be like, this is a role in a big movie. I'm like, I don't have time for that. I'm writing. And I left them, and then a few weeks later, I self-financed it. I gained a lot of confidence there, I think. And then with Con Man, I gained confidence in that my writing or my ideas about comedy might have value. A lot of roles that I've done, it's really interesting. A lot of roles that I've done, there'll be a moment of improv within the movie. I'll come up with a line. There's a line in 28 Days. Look at my package. Or there's a last scene about a plant dying and all of this plant. And that was just an improv scene that Betty Thomas was directing. She's like, just improv it. I don't know. We don't have lines for this. It was a new ending to the movie. And then when people say, oh, I love 28 Days, I loved it when you said, look at my package. Or I loved it when you said that thing about the plant. Or A Knight's Tale, they find the one line that, you know, it's called Alliance Hello. That was, I wrote that. Rogue One, especially, I wrote most of my lines in that movie.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing to me that on a project that size, mm-hmm. that you grew up with, and then it's in your hands and you're making it up as you go.
Yeah. They really, towards in the beginning it was just a thing I'd say here and there on take five that they would, then they're like, oh, we're going to use that. By the end, we were doing reshoots. I'm like, this line, I have two versions of this. I want to try this and that and this and that. I'm like, great. Oh, yeah, that one.
Really?
Yeah. And they trusted me. Like, go with my lines over written things. Like, no. Even when there was some pushback. Like, no. The line where I say, I'll be with you, Jin. Cassian says I had to. It's like right at the end where it's like the hurrah moment of we're all going to be behind you. We're going to be behind you. And I say, I'll be there with you, Jen. Cassian says, I had to. And he walks off. The original line was, I'll be there for you, Jen. Oh, she says, grab anything that isn't nailed down. And I said, I'm not nailed down, so I imagine I'll just grab myself. I was like, I don't even know what that means. It sounds kind of perverted to me. Can I do this other thing? And Tony, who did the rewrites, was like, I don't like it. I called him and said, like,
he didn't like your line.
My line. So, I get that you might want another line, but that isn't it. And John Schwartz, the producer, was there, and he's like, he said no? I'm like, yeah, he said no. He's like, well, I like yours, so we'll do yours. And it's one of those things where people go, I'm at Cannes signing. Cassian said I had to. That's the thing people want on their camera.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I mean, what I hear you saying is that was directly related to your experience writing Con Man.
Yeah. Like, where I would normally give my two cents on what I wanted or thought would be funny, I'm given $1.75 these days. I don't know.
Does it feel like it's a totally different career now than it was
it does feel like that with this play on Broadway, because I've always auditioned for Broadway, you know, and a lot of the roles in my career have been like down to the wire, like they really want somebody else for this, but the director's pushing for you, and it's between the director and the financing people whether or not you're going to get to do it.
Right.
And this was a call, like, do you want to do a play, a Steve Martin play? Jerry Zaks is directing with Amy Schumer, Keegan-Michael Key, and Laura Benanti. It's a four-person, four-hander. Yes. That's different.
What's the catch?
Yeah, okay. I guess I should read it first, but yes, that's different. But when I'm on set, I just know everybody else's job.
From directing
and producing and writing. Right. I know where there's leeway now. So when I do other people's things, I did, I think, Dirk Gently in the Holistic Detective Agency.
This
on BBC America. And doing that, I was absolutely like, can I get a little room over here? Can I do this? Can I do that?
Can I get a monitor?
Yeah, can I see playback? I did. There was one place where I was like, you need to relax. There was a camera right here doing my coverage, and the scene didn't work from there. And he yelled cut, and I was like, maybe if you're right there.
And Alan, that was the last time he worked.
Yeah, but the cameraman went, I know, that's where I should be. But yeah, I know. I've started to trust more that my improv is worthwhile. I normally would need a lot of permission to do it, but I have a lot of imagination in my world as I live my life. The other day, my wife is so wonderful, Carissa. We just got married. We haven't been married a year.
Congratulations.
Yeah, we're just about to have our anniversary. And I was in the kitchen. We were getting stuff for dinner, and I was thinking about, there's this thing in the play about these eggplants that get delivered to the house, and they're weird, and I have a thing about, what are these eggplants? Why are they here? There's a bow on them. And I was in the kitchen, and I was turned around, and then I realized, was thinking about it, and I was bent over looking at eggplants that aren't there, just thinking about, what is it about the eggplants? What is this thing? And my wife turned around, and she's like, did you hurt your back? Because I bent over. Like, oh, no, I was in a thing. There were eggplants here. It's just a thing in the play I just started thinking about. That I'm that guy in the grocery store, like, that guy's kind of crazy over there. Because if I'm thinking about a thing or a role or something, I'll start to leave. I'll start to drift.
But, I mean, to me, that sort of is what defines you. I feel like your brain works in an imaginative way that maybe you don't even fully grasp how. Like, I read some story about your Ice Age audition.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder what goes on in your brain that allows you to have this person, like the sense memory of who that person is that allows you to do a voice or allows you to be a character.
So again, it was from Bunny Bunny. The casting director saw me in Bunny Bunny. She's like, he does a lot of characters. Bring him in for this movie called Ice Age that we're casting. And they just gave me a stack of photos, like, do a voice for all of these characters. And there's like photos.
And you didn't get the photos in advance or anything?
No, they were there. And so you just do them. And then I got a call. You got three. Cool.
You got three voices.
Three voices from that. One was this Big Tiger. That was a hard one. I didn't like it. But I didn't like my work there. He was just like, I'm hungry. And then he kind of disappears really quickly. And there was some character. You know, I was one of the, there were three of us doing all the big, prepare for the Ice Age. You know, it was cool because I learned in animation, you could prepare for the Ice Age. And I had like a lisp. And then the last melon, and the animation, his tongue comes out of his beak and kind of slides along. He's like, that's my lisp being animated. That's cool. That play between the animators and the voice actors.
And that, you see a face and it immediately just, something comes out. Like the natural thing just comes out.
Make a choice, yeah. Sort of. That's how Disney does it.
It's a picture.
I know, you think of these Disney movies, and then there's like, yeah, let's go. The Duke of Wesselton dances like a chicken with the face of a monkey. Which, all of that came up with that on the day.
No kidding.
Yeah, that he was dancing, but all of the dance like a chicken with a face like a monkey. I fly, two and three and one. And then they animated it really well.
Well, I think you have this skill that immediately brings something to life. And to me, that skill is connected to childhood imagination. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're able to do reminds me of an artist in the purest childlike sense, that you can immediately go there.
You know what helps that? Clowning.
Really?
Truly, because they're all about discovery. They're like children who've never been told no. So they're always, you're going to find a lot in your environment, to play with and to play with your imagination, that the water's, you think the water's cold, but then it becomes hot, or it's sweet, or it's, you're just constantly playing. You need to find that world of playing.
You have clown in you.
I think I do. I could have. Yeah. I really think I could have. It is a discipline.
Well, I think that's why I'm drawn to your work. And you manage to bring a sense of wonder and imagination to the work you do. Your timing as a comedian, and especially with Con Man, I don't know where it's going. And I found all these points to relate with it. And I think what you're doing is just really cool. And I'm glad that you found a way to do it in another form. And it's clear that very act is doing what you want as an artist. Like, it's go out and make your own thing against the advice of people and against all the odds, and then all of a sudden these amazing rewards come, right?
Yeah.
Like, there might be a trophy waiting for you for Con Man. Thanks for coming and doing this.
Yeah, man, my pleasure. Cheers. Thanks.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening, and if you're at all curious about Alan Tudyk, obviously you can start with all of his voice work in the Disney films, but make sure you check out Con Man. You can see it on the Sci-Fi Channel. It's just this great absurd comedy, but at the center there's some really relatable stuff, and I enjoyed it immensely, and I know you will too. Also check out his film that he did in 2007 called Death at a Funeral if you want to laugh and see Alan at his most improvisational best. And if you like what we're doing around here at Off Camera, go to offcamera.com and check out the other things we do. If you've just listened to this as a podcast, you should know that we are also a television show, and you can watch Off Camera every week on DirecTV. You can also find us on Netflix, and you can also find us by getting the Off Camera monthly subscription. For under $5 a month, you can see every off-camera we've ever made. That's over 115 episodes in the comfort of your own home on any device you wish and as many times as you wish. It's a great way to catch up on all these conversations, and it also supports the show. So check that out at offcamera.com. You can also see our print magazine and subscribe to our emails, and there's a lot of ways to interact with us. So come on over to offcamera.com and join the fun. You can find us on social media. We are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I'm Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. Or just send me an email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. I'd love to hear your guest suggestions, comments, criticisms, and any other questions you might have. Just send them my way. I also want to take a moment to thank everybody that works on this show. It's a lot of work to put a show out each week, and I couldn't do it without all these fine people. Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Laura Kemper, Michaela Galvin, Cara Johnson, Amy Jones, and of course, Matt Davidson, who takes care of all the rodents and cleans out the gutters and pulls the weeds from the sidewalk out in front of the building. Thank you, Matt. And most of all, I want to thank you, the listeners, for supporting this show and being here with us every week. And be sure to join us next week when I sit down with stand-up comedian, actor, and author Tom Papa.
I remember I drove into the city once. I put my suit on and my hard shoes, and I had a meeting with this guy sitting in his cubicle. He's just bursting at the seams on his shirt, and he's sitting there, and he's asking me, do you want to be an accountant? Are you going to service the people? Are you going to write and do all that? And he's just, like, kind of pissy, and I'm looking at this guy, and I'm like, I just drove all this way to become that. Like, if I get the job, and in 15 years, is the reward being him? That's something wrong with that.
As an 11-year-old,
He was shocked to discover that making people laugh for money was actually a job that a grown man could do. What he had yet to discover was how to do it. Being funny is one thing. Telling a well-crafted joke is quite another. Tom joins me to talk about how he learned the difference, where his humor comes from, and the perks and pitfalls of having Jerry Seinfeld as a fan and a friend. He also shares a preview of his first book. It's coming out soon, but something tells me he won't be celebrating at Cheesecake Factory. See you next time, off camera.